Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. Glad you're with us tonight, this morning, rather, for some of you in the Eastern time zones. I think you're going to like this segment. I'm sure you're going to like it, in fact. Those of you who are familiar with the UFO topic have heard the term close encounters of the second kind. It was a phrase coined by the late J. Allen Hynek, one of the most important scientists to ever study the UFO topic. A close encounter of the second kind involves instances where there is physical interaction between a UFO and its environment, a landing trace, like depressed grass or soil, but also burned or broken vegetation, residues, exotic traces. There are in excess of 3,500 of these kinds of cases that have been researched. And the person who knows more about this subject in the world than anyone is our guest, Ted Phillips, who founded something called the Center for Physical Trace Research. Ted, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, George.
Hey, hi, am I embarrassing you?
No.
Okay. I told you I'd have you back on, and when we got some time to talk about some of this stuff, I got an email. I'm on your subscriber list for your website, and I got an email today that informed me that you were going to be on the program tonight, which, of course, I knew. And it said that it promised that you're going to break some big news. Is that an exaggeration?
No, it's not. No, we're quite excited. It's related to the Project Moonshaft.
Okay. Well, don't give it away. Just don't give it away yet. Right. Let's take it a step at a time on Project Moonshaft. I mean, reading about this, I love this story. I love it.
Yes.
It should be a movie. I mean, take me to the beginning, because it starts in the waning days of World War II. The war is still raging in Europe. Set the stage.
Yes, and it is. It's an exceedingly fascinating story. In 1944, October, a 184-man battalion of Slovakian insurgent fighters are in an extreme firefight with the German, and the Germans open up with heavy artillery, and of course the insurgents are quite outnumbered, and as it all winds up, of the 184 men, only three survive, and one of those is Antonin Hurok, who is a Czech engineer and is a captain in the underground insurgent army, and one of the soldiers named Yurik, the other Martin, and they have varying degrees of injuries, and they're left for dead by the Germans. And the next morning, as written in Tony's daily diary he maintained through the war, he says that he regained consciousness and was being treated by a tall Slovakian whose name, nickname actually, was Slavik. And Slavik had built a stretcher for Martin, who was most seriously injured. And so when this was all finished and the wounds were treated, he took the three men on a four-hour hike into the mountains where they approached a cave with a very small entrance. The entrance was concealed by a number of stones, and he removed the stones, took them inside into a rather expansive entrance room, and immediately began performing the holy rites on himself, the men, and the cave. And, of course, this struck Tony Hurok as very odd. Why would he be blessing not only the men but the cave? So that indicated to him that it was of some significance to this Slovakian farmer. And as Slavik was getting ready to leave the cave, he asked Hurok not to explore his cave, not to go deeper into the cave. And his explanation was that he had been back in it one time, and that it had bottomless pits, dangerous gas, and was surely haunted.
He's hinting that it's something evil in the cave or something scary,
just that
spooky?
It was haunted. And it was, of course, discouraging Tony from exploring this cave at all for some reason. And so he left. He replaced the stones over the entrance so the Germans wouldn't find the cavern. And being an engineer, a mining engineer, and because they had not had any food for 4 days, Tony grabs his rifle and carbide lamp, some torches, and heads back into the cave. And he's looking primarily for bats for food. And so he gets into exploring this thing, and he told me it was truly a magnificent cave, very complex. And after going some 2 miles back into the cave, a period of about an hour and a half, he comes upon a long, level corridor or passage, which ends at a crawl space. And as he goes through the crawl space, the cavern once again opens up into a large room, and he sees at the opposite side of the room a very large jet black expanse of wall, which is totally different from anything in the cave, different from anything that he's ever seen before. And what is truly fascinating is that this expanse of wall, which is indicated by one of the sketches in his diary, is framed by flowstone formations, stalactites, that have actually affixed themselves, grown, on the wall itself.
But there's no way that this is a natural, completely natural formation?
Well, at this point, he couldn't be sure. He could just see this, and he described it as jet black, like looking into a black mirror. It was seamless, perfectly smooth, and yet it had kind of the appearance of some sort of odd metal. And he noted a crack coming diagonally across the this open expanse, and where the crack reached the floor of the cavern, he thought he might be able to wriggle through it. And by removing his clothes, which he did, he made several attempts to get through this. It's extremely narrow, and finally was able to get through the crack. And as he went through, he could see that the thickness of this wall was 7 feet, which is pretty substantial. And when he reaches the inside portion of the outer wall, he's on a very steep, about a 40-degree incline, and he starts rolling down it, loses his carbide lamp, and rolls until he hits the back wall of this structure. And he gets a couple of torches lit, and with the carbide light, he can see that he's now inside of a huge curved structure.
Hold on there, Ted, for a second. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, you're going to describe what else that structure looks like and the rest of your research regarding Project Moonshaft. Stick around, everyone, for more of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. We're talking with Ted Phillips of the Center for Physical Trace Research and discussing his work on something called Project Moonshaft. Ted, you've been working on this since 1970?
Yes,
wow.
I have.
That's a pretty big chunk of your life.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Well, pick up the story there. The diary of Tony Horak, end of World War II. He's in this weird cave. He falls down a shaft, and he's seeing this odd structure. Take it from there.
Right. At any rate, as he fires up the carbide light, he's able to see, and you can imagine, in a pitch-black structure, light is absorbed pretty quickly, so his vision is somewhat limited. And but he's standing there looking basically up a huge shaft that is going vertically about 16 degrees off of vertical upward, and of course can't see the top of this. Well, he's looking at a beautifully, as he said, mathematically curved wall, which is the front wall that he just came through. And at the back wall, which is like curved, and the shape of the structure is like that of a kind of thin half moon. And he's standing on limestone drippage, and which is what he had rolled down. And again, this material is jet black. It's very slick and seamless, and he's trying to understand what on earth he's looking at in there. And this is a guy that that owned a number of mines and had worked in mines and underground a good part of his life, so he understood the underworld. And so he is in there for a period of time, goes back through the crack to try to find some bats, go back to his men to feed them, and each day that they're hidden in the cavern, he goes back to this structure, and each time he'll take more torches to try to get better illumination to see the top of this thing, which he's never able to determine. It just continues upward. And so he starts working on, after measuring the structure, which is 85 feet long and 27 feet from the inside of the back wall to the inside of the front wall. And he starts working on the limestone area beneath his feet, which he at this point is assuming is the floor of this whatever it is. And he has his pickaxe, and he starts breaking through the limestone. And over a period of about 3 days, he manages to go down through about 60 inches of the limestone deposit. Now, generally, and it varies according to the amount of drippage in the cavern, but generally, that would be something along 6,000 years of limestone deposit. And when he's gone through that, he comes on to the skeleton of a very large animal. And he extracts two of the teeth of this animal, puts them in his pocket so he can try to identify it later. And the fascinating thing is that this large skeleton is lying on what he described as a constructed wavy grill that extends downward. And he senses some heat coming up through this, and he places his cheek on the grill, and indeed it is warm air coming through. And a very far distant down below his feet, below this grill work, he can hear what sounded to him like a large turbine moving, working. And, of course, we're extremely interested in what that might be. And remember, this is 1944, 2 miles back in a cave in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And so he continues to explore this thing over the next week. Martin dies. They take him out to the trenches where he was shot and bury him. And then Tony and Yurik are leaving the cavern to go to the near the city of Kosciuszko to the east to rejoin their military group. And they continued the fight on into the Ukraine against the Germans with the Russians. And the war ends in early 1945. And as Tony is returning home in Bohemia, in northern Czech Republic, he stops in the cave area. And he looks at the entrance through a pair of field glasses from a distance of about 300 feet from the forest. And the entrance is still covered by the stones, so no one can find Slavik's cave. And as he was leaving the Ukraine, he stops at one of the largest museums in the Ukraine, shows these teeth to the curator, who identifies them as prehistoric cave bear. And remembering, of course, these were found underneath 60 inches of limestone deposit inside the artifact, 2 miles back in the cave. So it becomes quite evident that this structure, whatever it may be, is exceedingly old. There are good indications that this thing actually predated the cavern itself, and the cavern formed, then the formations began forming and actually formed on the face of the outer wall of this structure. So we're talking something many, many thousands of years old. So it becomes pretty interesting. What is it? And as Alan Hynek always liked to say, it's an itch that ought to be scratched. And so...
Well, you've been scratching it for, 38 years
38
now?
38 years, yes.
How did you get involved? Was it through Hynek?
Well, eventually, Alan was involved, but I received a call from a investigator friend who was with the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization in 1970. And he said, Ted, you've got to come out and visit with my neighbor who is from Bohemia. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting, but why? And he told me his story. And so a week and a half later, I was in Colorado in the home of Tony and Anna Hurok. As Tony explained to me this story, and I viewed his diary that he kept all through the World War II, and he wanted very much a scientific investigation to determine what this thing is. And so I said, well, we might just be able to arrange something like that. So I photographed the sketches and the diary and called Alan Hynek, and he and I met in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I showed him the photographs, and we discussed it. Alan drove up and met with Tony Hurok and was so impressed by it, he said, we've got to try to get to this thing. And so working with Jim and Coral Lorenzen of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, they arranged for a meeting with Jackie Gleason, the actor and comedian. And Gleason agreed to fund a trip for me to try to find this. And, of course, the Russians kind of foul things up when they invaded Czechoslovakia in 68.
That's nervy of them.
Made it pretty dangerous and difficult to go over there. But Hurok had established contact with four of his friends in Prague, and had arranged for them to help me get supplies and reach this very isolated area. And before I could go, the Russians arrested these four individuals, and they were executed. And thus ended the 1970 expedition.
Hey, Ted, hold on. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be coming back to hear more about this strange structure hidden in a cave in Slovakia and what it might mean. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. For 38 years, our guest tonight, Ted Phillips, has been researching something he has dubbed Moonshaft, a very odd structure and artifact that was found in a cave in Slovakia. Ted has promised us some very big news tonight, and when we come back, we're going to pick up the story of what was in this weird cave, what it might mean, and what his big news is. So stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Our guest tonight, Ted Phillips, the world's foremost authority on close encounters of the second kind, landing site trace cases. He's describing for us a project he's been working on for 38 years now, something that he has dubbed Project Moonshaft. All right, let's pick up the story. Ted, do you you get the diary of this guy, this Czechoslovakian, who had found something very strange at the waning days of World War II in this cave, something very old, an unusual structure, and an artifact. You talk Jackie Gleason into financing a trip over there for you, so you can see it firsthand. That trip is put off for a long time because the Russians had the bad manners to invade Czechoslovakia. I understand, I remember reading something that at some point, as you're planning to go over there, not everyone was happy about the prospect that you're going to go into their cave, right? One guy who sort of claimed ownership of the cave of his, as his own?
Well, the Slovakian that rescued Tony and the two soldiers considered this his cave, yes. And he did tell Tony back at that point in time that he had been in the cavern one time. He was taken into it by his grandfather and his father. And that's the way things operate in those East European countries. For example, Slavik had two daughters, and he would never have told the daughters about the artifact. And it's passed on only to the sons, and Slavik had no sons, but it was passed on to his father from his grandfather and so on. And they took him into the cavern that one time to show him their discovery, which was the artifact. And obviously, it was considered some sort of religious artifact to them, which is understandable with the culture. And so Slavik felt that it was his duty to protect the cave from outsiders. And so consequently, he was very upset when in 1970, we have on the website a copy of a letter which was written to Tony by his good friend Carl Matausik, who Hurok had asked to visit Jurek in Bratislava in 1970 in order to get a map that would help me find the cave. And in the return letter from Matausik, he said that Slavik was there when he asked Jurek, and Slavik became very enraged because Tony had gone back to the artifact. And as a matter of fact, Tony didn't even mention this structure to Jurek, who was in the cave with him. And Tony told me when I met with him in 1970 that his main concern obviously was the scientific investigation of it, but to not have cave robbers or tomb robbers, as he called them, go in and destroy the artifact trying to figure out a way to get it out of the cave or pieces of it or whatever, or start trying to blow the mountain apart. And so he was very protective of it. He wanted it maintained as such so it could be studied. He realized this was something of great importance. And so after I couldn't go there in 1970, it was something that I continued to research as best I could, and pre-internet and so on, and from a great distance. And finally, in 1999, I did get the funding to go. So I went, unfortunately, the funding would only take me there, so I went over by myself. And it's a pretty difficult thing to track the history of a man back into the World War II period when you can't read the signs and you can't speak the language.
So did you find the cave?
No, I didn't. I searched for it as best I could, and the problem was the local villagers, because of the Russian dominance, and before that the Nazis had control of the company, they're very leery of foreigners. And so it was extremely difficult to get any kind of information. So I was just basically on my own, and searching for this thing. Well, it's some pretty rugged country to look for a small cave entrance, especially by yourself. So I spent 6 weeks there, and I got a lot of new information and bits and pieces and clues. And it was then 2001 until I could go back again.
Well, before we jump to that, you learned at some point that the Russians, while they were occupying Czechoslovakia, had done their own search. Their own investigation. Did you ever see what the results of that investigation were?
No, I've not been able to determine that. The only thing I've been able to determine is that they have not found the cave. And because I received emails from a couple of Russian scientists, and actually the Russian project began in 1981, the search for this cave. And when I was contacted by these Russian scientists in 1999, after I returned from the first trip, they asked me basically, we too are looking for the moon shaft, and could we work together?
Do you have the feeling that these Russians were attached to the Ministry of Defense, or they're just doing it on their own?
No, this was a pretty large official project, and I had known about that, and but what the results were, I wasn't sure until I got this request for me to work with them. Then, of course, I realized, well, they haven't found it, or they wouldn't need me. And so I sent them a little bit of kind of deceptive suggestions as to where to look. And so they're probably still looking. It's an extremely rugged section I sent them to. And and hoping, you know, that I eventually would get back. Well, 2001 I did, and I picked up a great deal of information. I was trying to confirm the things that Hurok had told me about his history, dating back even to his childhood. I went to the village where he was born, and I started seeing some really interesting things. It's a little difficult to understand. And that is, it began in the village where he was actually born. He and his parents were on vacation. They had a vacation home in this village over near the Polish border. And after he was old enough to travel, of course, he went back to their home near the German border in North Czech Republic. And so when I went to the village, I found a young guy that could translate for me, and he took me to the village major, which would be our equivalent of a mayor, the guy that handles all the records. And he asked for me, could we see any records on the Hurok family? And he kind of laughed, and he said, he told him, no, that he no longer had any records on the Hurok family. Because in the early 1980s, he received a request from Kosciuszko to gather up and send all records on the Hurok family to Kosciuszko, which is kind of an odd request. And so then I went to the place that he lived, where they had the family properties, and I hired a historian, a lady whose business it was to track down family histories. And she said, I'll have it finished for you in about 2 weeks. Come back. So in 2 weeks, I went back. And the lady somehow was spirited away to some other location, but she left me a note saying that it was impossible to find any records on the Hurok family. And this was a huge expanse of land that they owned for many generations, and yet all of the records were gone.
Well, let's jump ahead. You do finally find the cave, right?
No, I have not found the cave. I've got the area narrowed down. I'm quite sure of where it is. And so, of course, now it's a matter of going back the third time and getting to it. And even at having the area narrowed way down, it's still a problem of finding a camouflaged small entrance. In some of Tony's sketches in his diary, thank goodness, he did sketch the area as it appeared out in front of the location of the cave. And there are some landmarks that are relatively easy to spot. And I'm quite sure I know where the thing is. And so now the big announcement, big for us at any rate, is that we now have enough funding to go back. And so the team is trying to get everything together so we can go back and reach the cave and hopefully reach the artifact. Another interesting thing, and what makes me quite sure the Russians, even if they had found the cave, could not find the artifact, is that I have the original sketch of the cavern made by Hurok, and when he gave me this copy, he pointed out and he marked three locations on his last trip out after Martin had died. He knew they would be leaving the cave. He covered up small passageways in three locations that would allow you to get on back to the artifact. And he said he did it in such a way, without the map and the areas marked, you could find the cave, but you would never find the artifact. So we, we're quite sure that it is still there and as yet undiscovered.
Well, let's cut to the chase in this thing, Ted. What do you think it is?
That's the big question. Even Hurok, who, again, was quite familiar with the underground, in his diary, which is on our website, he sat there in this structure pondering what it could be. And this was an extremely intelligent man that could fluently speak seven languages, had 4 degrees in engineering, all of which I was able to confirm while I was over there in 2001, was trying to understand what it was he was looking at, and he couldn't. And he comes down to the idea that perhaps in the future we might be able to understand what it is. But he could find no purpose for a thing like this.
I know you're a scientifically trained guy, that you like to play your cards close to the vest. You don't want to wildly speculate on anything. But I mean, you know, the sound of this is like it might be some kind of a craft. It generates heat. It had a grill. It sounded like it was at a turbine going, like it's some kind of a big craft or machine that's been there for thousands of years, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It certainly, the indications are, first of all, and again, it is extremely old. This thing has been in existence for a very long period of time. And it's pretty interesting that something could still be running inside it. And so you have to consider, well, first of all, by the structure itself, much less that something continues to run there after all this period of time. It was constructed by a pretty advanced civilization. And so then the question becomes, what civilization existed that long ago that could have constructed something? And there is an interesting aside in the fact that a Russian scientist has been investigating ancient manuscripts in which there was described the descent of a large dark object which was somewhat cylindrical many years ago in Siberia, and the thing settled onto the Siberian plain and was so tall that it could be seen by villagers from miles away. And it emitted a lot of just ear-shattering sounds. And over a period of time, it seemed to grow shorter. And finally it disappeared, the noises stopped, and the villagers gained enough confidence to go there, and they found not this enormous thing, but a huge hole into the ground, where evidently this thing had somehow pushed itself deep into the ground. And it is emitting a pulsing electromagnetic signal. And I understand that the Russians have now located another similar signal in Yugoslavia. And so, of course, immediately I thought, well, could there be three of these things and perhaps even more?
You don't really have a firm grip on what the ultimate size of this thing is or what its ultimate shape is, do you?
Well, you have the shape, at least the area that he could see. And the problem is, we have no idea on the total size of this
thing. But it's big.
It's huge, yes.
So let's say the ultimate happens. You find the cave, you find the artifact. It's very interesting. You'd love to get it out of there and study it and see what the heck it is. How would you even ever go about that? Do you have a plan for that?
There would be no getting it out because it's about 2,700 feet below the mountaintop and it's 2 miles back in the mountain.
Oh boy!
So and it's far too large to move. And so the plan is that when we reach it, we have the right kind of equipment to obtain samples, which will be a problem in itself because he tried hitting it with the pickaxe, couldn't even scratch the surface of this thing, and he actually took his military rifle back in there and at risk of his life and ears. He fired at the side of this at an oblique angle, hoping to chip off some pieces, and the bullet didn't scratch anything.
Oh boy.
When the bullet hit, it did give off green sparks and a very pungent odor. And in a cave setting, you can imagine how much noise. He was, however, able, as he was going back and forth through this outer wall, the crack, he did find some very odd powder, and he made some homemade glue out of pigeon claws and put it on a piece of leather from his belt. And on one occasion, he was able to pick up some of this powdery material from the wall itself. And he put that along with his gold pocket watch in a glass jar and sealed it and put it on the slope inside the artifact. And he marked the location for me. And he said, here would be a sample.
So and that would be something you could test if you could find it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know precisely where this sample is at. And in the structure. And
okay. Ted, we're going to have to take another break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about this subterranean artifact. We'll also get into the mystery of the Marley Woods and Close Encounters of the Second Kind cases that you've researched around the world. Stay with us for Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, everyone. We're rocking into the midnight hour here on Coast to Coast AM with the world's foremost authority on Close Encounters of the Second Kind. His name is Ted Phillips, and we've been talking about Project Moonshaft, his 38-year investigation into a weird artifact and structure found in a cave in Slovakia. Ted, before we leave the subject, anything else? You need a reporter to go along with you when you make this trip?
Oh, guys. Well, yeah, that would be nice.
You probably get a lot of volunteers, don't you?
Well, you know, of course, I'm here in Chicago today, and we just did a conference, and I was talking about the moonshaft, and even though we do have the money to get back over there, we need some additional funds, not a huge amount of money, for supplies, so we might be able to eat while we're there, and also to buy a few pieces of equipment Because what we have to do, it doesn't do any good to find the artifact, to go in there and then come back out and say, guys, we found it, and expect science to believe us. And so what we have to be sure of is to be able to produce samples that we can bring out to be analyzed so we can say, okay, look, this is what we've got, whatever it is, and to document the fact it does exist. And so we're that's the only holdup. We would be on our way probably in about 2 weeks. And or as soon as we get the additional funding to get the equipment and some supplies.
Well, if anyone wants to help, I guess they can go to your website. There's a link on the Coast to Coast website. Any wealthy folks out there, or even modestly wealthy folks who want to pitch in, I guess you'd accept some help.
Absolutely. Yeah, if we could get enough people to send the price of a couple of gallons of gas, we'd be on our way. And I just think this is a tremendously significant thing, and it certainly needs to be looked at, researched, identified. And, of course, my idea with this always has been, once we establish where it's at and that it is, and we can bring out enough evidence to convince a small team of select scientists, because I don't want to deal with people that will you'll give them samples and never see the samples again and get no response publicly. This is something that I've always firmly believed in, making the data, whatever it is, available to the public. And it does no good to research this stuff, cases or this thing or anything else, and then put it in a file cabinet. And that's really what we're trying to do with our research and the website, is to make it available. And another thing that we plan to do is basically take along anyone that wants to take the time to go to the website and go with us, in that we will have a daily report, including video and digital images, which will be a daily diary of our progress over there. And if we get into the cave in almost real time, they're going to be able to go with us. And that's the way I think it should be handled. And the UFO research the same way. And that's what we're really trying to get done. And I'm doing right now a lot of checking into precisely what kind of equipment it will take to have a good chance of getting samples. And then, of course, what we're going to have to really, truly document the fact that it's there. And then we can go to specific scientists that you can trust to be open with the public. And
one other question on this. You ever heard of a similar artifact at a place called Talon? Because I had heard something about that in my travels in Russia a couple of times, that there was some big underground artifact, like maybe a ship, at a place called Talon. I think it's in the Ukraine.
You know, I haven't. Okay. No, I'd be very interested to hear about that, though.
Well, we can chat about that then. Let's move on to some other topics. One of the other big episodes that you've been investigating for quite some time is what's been dubbed the Marley Woods episodes and encounters. Tell me about that. Is it more than lights in the sky?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is such a terrific thing that I was kind of thrown into the middle of, happily. In December of 1998, I received a call from a rancher some distance from where I live, and he said, we have been seeing some really crazy stuff. And he had checked me out through a security firm to be sure I wasn't, you know, a serial killer or something, and that I could be trusted. And he said, would you come take a look at this and see if you can explain what's going on? And what had happened was this man and his wife and his family, his son and daughter, suddenly one evening they're driving to the ranch, and they see some brilliant white objects, and they're just hovering there, and pretty close to the ranch. And as they approach this thing, they can see three circular white lights in a horizontal row, and lots of tiny little white lights. And as they approach it, it suddenly just vanishes. Well, they drive on a distance of probably half mile to their ranch and up the front drive, and there's an old cabin there. It's in a very remote area. And as they approach the cabin, they see the same thing once again, just north of the cabin. And so they stop the car at the top of the hill. They get out. They watch this thing. It moves away to the northeast, disappears behind a tree line. And as they're sitting there in the car, it's, of course, quite cold. And they see what looks like a greenish-white glow coming up the hill towards the automobile. And they can't see an object, but just the glow, as though you had headlights shining there, but it couldn't quite come over the top. And it got closer and closer and went out. And then they start seeing sort of beams of light sweeping one of their fields. They can't see a source of light, just the beams and the illuminated areas in the field. And it really troubled him. And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll come down, come over. And I went there, and in the meantime, by the time I got there, they had had some more sightings. And normally, in years gone by, if I ran onto a witness that claimed to have sighting after sighting, I would just wouldn't bother with it. And so, I, you know, doubting the credibility of the witness if you're seeing something over and over. And, however, in this instance, these people were just so credible.
And there were a lot of other witnesses, too, and we'll pick up that part of the story when we come back after this short break. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. We're speaking with Ted Phillips about the Marley Woods investigation. Okay, before the break, Ted, you were telling us about these strange lights and then the spotlights that are sweeping the field that witnesses saw. Give me a laundry list of the other kinds of evidence that you've accumulated, including the sheer number of witnesses you've accumulated regarding sightings in that same area.
Yeah, pretty interesting stuff, George. It they have seen in the past 10 years that I have been there, they have had every type of UFO report across the spectrum except for little guys. No humanoid reports, although we are currently looking into some humanoid type reports, perhaps. It's early to say, but some kind of interesting events have been taking place, not involving little guys, but some real strange guys. And, but it just, it really runs, the gamut as far as types of events.
Well, hold on there a second. Strange guys meaning like what? What do you say? What are you saying there?
Well, let me give you one example. And this lady reported to the sheriff's department, and they actually went out and did an investigation. This lady in a very, very rural area, in daylight, her son was out in the yard in front of the farmhouse playing with a basketball, and of course she kind of kept an eye on the boy. And all of a sudden, this very odd guy, very tall, extremely thin, unusually tall, was approaching a barbed wire fence a short distance from the boy. And instead of jumping over or climbing over, she said he appeared to float over the fence and came down on the ground and walked up to the boy and took the basketball. And she was not going to have a whole lot of that, so she grabbed a shotgun, cocked it open there, and popped him. And the thing just moved a little faster. He dropped the basketball, floated over the fence, and back out into the woods.
She shot this humanoid thing?
Yes.
She just shot him for taking the basketball?
Yes, she did. She didn't like that. And so... So at any rate, and she reported it to the sheriff. Sheriff came out. They filed a report and all this. And since there was no blood, there was no body or anything, why, you know, and the sheriff's department was not too interested after she described this guy because he was so weird looking. And when you say floating over a fence, law enforcement people get a little itchy. And but then we found a couple of other reports by other individuals who claimed to have seen these same type of figures, and they are dressed in pretty well in black. They are hooded and have just sort of a long body length black garment of some kind on. It's just weird. It's just out of the ordinary, and especially in this particular area. And I wouldn't want to be walking around in this area back in the woods in some kind of long black garment, because those folks just might get their shotguns out.
Okay. In addition to eyewitness accounts of lights and beings, what about physical evidence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had about 16, I believe the current number is 16 trace cases. And they involve, for example, a 10-foot circular area where the vegetation was swirled and compressed, and the central area was pretty well untouched. And this was in a barbed wire encased cattle chute, and that's simply an area about 12 feet across where you would drive cattle from one field to the other. And the edge on one side of the ring was 6 inches from the barbed wire and a foot and a half on the east side. And they had sightings of bright white lights in that area the night before. And what's really interesting about that particular case is that 6 weeks after the ring was found, the farmer, the rancher, had to drive his cattle up that chute to another field. The ring was still very visible, and as 166 cattle approached the ring, they suddenly started bolting. They tore up a good bit of the barbed wire fence, bent over some of the fence posts, steel posts, and they managed to get them back under control and back down the chute a ways. And so then they started driving them through single file, and I've got a beautiful photograph of this after the fact. 166 cattle went past this ring in a 1.5 foot wide area, and not one ever touched any part of the ring. They wanted totally no part of this thing. And on what we call site 3, which is south, about 4,000 feet of site 1, the rancher was riding his horse, and the horse almost threw him off and refused to go forward. He got off the horse, and he walked forward, and he found 2 10-foot rings, which were singed and charred a bit. And the horse would not approach either of these rings. And very shortly after that, he told me that he was birthing a number of calves, and a calf would be born, and as he would leave in the evening, he would check on the calf, and it and its mother would be standing there in this one particular area. And this is a very much a locked up ranch, and he locks everything up as he goes out. The next morning he comes back, and he finds the mother standing there, and all that's left of the calf is a skeleton, nothing inside or out. And 5-6 feet away is a 10-foot burned ring. And this is repeated 8 times, each time with a 10-foot burned ring. And believe me, it would be virtually impossible for anyone to get in to this area.
You said it would happened 8 times, meaning with the same rancher, or eight
yes.
times in the Marley
yes.
Woods?
And,
wow.
Yeah, and all in a field within perhaps 100 yards. So that's pretty strange. And he had two sets of 12-foot steel gates that were pushed to the ground. And the steel pivots, half-inch steel pivots, which were in 4-inch oak posts, were rotated 90 degrees in the tightening position. And the gates were down. They were still chained together with a log chain at the middle. And there were no dents, no scrapes, no marks of any kind on these gates, indicating any kind of impact. And that also happened, an identical event, over on Site 1.
And tell me this, Ted. You said that you've been looking into this Marley Woods case for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Any kind of indication of how long this kind of weird stuff's been going on in that area from the locals as it goes back, way back?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we've been able, the earliest case we've been able to find so far was 1937. And we found a number of ranchers who, for a period of, say, 20 years when they owned the properties, would see small white light balls, which is really, to me, one of the most intriguing parts of this whole thing, near the ground, below the treetops, and just sort of cavorting around in the fields. And they actually, the sons, for 20 years, would go out on motorcycles and pick up trucks and chase these things, trying to catch them. And we've had that from three different sites. And the light balls, we've had 172 cases reported of these small light balls. They range in size from the diameter of a baseball to a softball to a basketball. And some pretty interesting cases. For example, a couple of skeptics, a couple of attorneys, married couple, decide they've been hearing about some lights moving around and so on. So they went down to this area, parked their car, and they got out. They were standing 10 feet apart. And suddenly up at a tree line about 800 feet from them, they see a cluster of these small white lights just sort of frolicking around up and down across and very close to the ground. And after watching these for about 3 minutes, two of the light balls came out of the cluster in their direction. And as they're approaching, one of the light balls suddenly makes a right angle turn across the field and disappears in trees.
Hold on a second, Ted. We need to take a short break.
All right.
On that inopportune note, we're going to come back in just a moment and pick up the story on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We were hearing a story from Ted Phillips about two lawyers who were skeptics about the reported activity in the Marley Woods area, so they went out to check it out for themselves. I hope you're going to end this story, Ted, by telling me these lawyers were abducted and were never seen again.
Yeah, I wish I could do that. No, at any rate, where we left off, the two light balls are coming towards them. The one makes a right angle and across the field and into the trees. However, the second light ball continues on. The couple is standing 10 feet apart, and as the remaining light ball approaches them, it passes between the two people shoulder height. And they felt no heating, no cooling, no electrical charges, no sound, no air disturbance, nothing. They said it was the size of a softball, intense white, and nothing visible except the light itself. It passed between them. They turned. They watched as it flew on over a gravel road, made a right-angle turn, went into trees, and disappeared. And that is a relatively common sort of report for these light balls. It is truly fascinating. We had, I think, one of the really interesting cases. We just talked to the witnesses recently, where a lady's two children were playing on and near a trampoline behind their farm home, and a little girl was jumping on the trampoline, and she kind of lost her balance and fell to the trampoline surface. And her brother was standing by the edge of the trampoline, And as she started to get up, she looked up, and here was a light ball about the size of a basketball. And I asked her, how far was it from you? And she held her arm out, and she said, right here. It was about 2 feet from her face. And so obviously she and her brother went in to a very nervous situation. They were screaming. They were crying. The mother was about 150 feet away, walking away, and she turned. And as she turned, this thing was already gone. She returned to the kids. She calmed them down. They told her what happened. And as they're standing there talking about this, and her brother-in-law was there also, they saw then to the north, at a distance of a couple of hundred feet, three of the light balls in a kind of triangular pattern just hovering there. And as they watched, the light balls start changing positions with each other instantly. I mean, it would just be an instant leap. And they continued this pattern over and over and over. And the mother was very agitated because this one had been so close to her daughter. And she really got fed up with it, and she started walking towards them at a pretty good rate and screaming at them, you know, come on, let me see what you are. You know, I want to see. And as she approached them, the lower of the light balls suddenly and instantly went from its position to a position very close to her and hovered at about just about level with her face, and then instantly returned, and the position switching pattern started again, and this continues for a couple of minutes, and then she starts towards them again, and this is repeated with the lower light ball shooting at her, hovering and then returning. And this whole thing went on for about 15 minutes, four witnesses. And, you know, that's extraordinary stuff.
Yeah, that's weird. Tell me this. You heard me during the break compare it to the Skinwalker Ranch, and I don't know if you're familiar with that at
yes,
all,
I
but
am.
It's,
yeah.
You know, that ranch in northeastern Utah that myself and some others have looked into and written about, it's sort of like a paranormal Disneyland where all sorts of things had happened. And including Sasquatch and poltergeist type activity, anything like a Sasquatch event in the Marley Woods area, anything that would be comparable to poltergeist activity?
Not really, no. At least that we're aware of at this point, no poltergeist activity. There was one report. A guy thought he saw something like a Bigfoot. I guess we may have to buy us an old freezer and move it down there just in case, George.
Yeah. Hey, tell me this. Is there any kind of Native American connection to that that land, that property, that area?
No, absolutely not. No. It, you know, we've tried to look at why.
Yeah, that's the obvious question.
Since you don't know what you're dealing with, really, it's difficult to say, well, why even? And it is, we've tried to look at patterns. The only thing I can tell you is it's an area with three primary sites within about less than 5,000 feet of each other, and it extends over an area probably 2 miles wide and 2 or 3 miles north and south. And tremendous in that area since 1998, we have 551 known reports, and we have now 219 witnesses, none of which want any publicity, and which is why we have to keep the location and, of course, their names confidential. They're all on file, but. What does that say about 219 witnesses? Not one has gone public. You don't make up some big, stupid story and not tell anyone.
Tell me this. Have others figured out where the location is? I'm talking about like looky-loos or amateur investigators or folks like that?
No. 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 At least they haven't shown up on anyone's doorstep down there. So.
Well, can you guess? Extraterrestrial, interdimensional? You don't even want to guess, do you?
Well, let me tell you, in 40 years, I had never seen anything outside of the landing sites that I couldn't identify. And about 6 months into the investigation, in other words, in 1999, I'm standing there by a windmill with the Site 1 owner, and it's daylight. And suddenly he says, there they are. And I look up, and to the northeast, there are three of these things, the large amber objects, in a horizontal row. And to say that I was surprised, I was surprised. And suddenly, then, number four comes on, followed by number five. Number five was close. And it was perhaps at most 800 feet away and probably 200 feet above the ground. And as I stand there looking at this thing, it is an elongated object, oval, vertically. And the central area is filled with the oddest shade of orange-yellow light I've ever seen. It's brilliant, even in daylight, and yet it's a soft light. And around the outer edge of this thing, coming down like from the top on each side and around the base, like a horseshoe, is the strangest shade of purple, a band of this purple light, open at the top, but then this horseshoe shape configuration coming around the outside. And no propellers, no wings, no engines, no parachutes, no smoke, no strings, and they would have been quite visible because it is quite daylight. And I stood there for a minute and 37 seconds with my video camera in my hand shooting the ground. And I mean, it was totally, I was totally unprepared for what I was seeing. If it had been a metal disc with little guys crawling all over the top of it, I would have caught every bit of it on video. And so I've got a minute and 37 seconds of the owner and I discussing the sighting and a lot of gravel on the image. And before I even realized, I had the camera and had it, was holding it. The effect of seeing this is difficult to describe. And what I'm almost ashamed to say is that as I looked at it, I didn't think this was particularly an extraterrestrial craft, but rather I expected something to come through it. And
you thought it was a portal or something?
The only thing my brain was thinking was a portal, and I don't even believe in those things, to tell you the truth. And yet my brain's saying that's what you're looking at, and it was a totally unnerving experience. And but this is the only place on this planet that I've seen something that I absolutely couldn't understand. And that has been followed by a number of instances in which I, along with 18, 20, 25 other people, observe this stuff and actually have photographed it. Some of the photos you see are... I actually took those myself, and I have.
That's what I was going to ask. Have you got a lot of good photos, and what about video?
Yes, yes. Actually, what happened was after the property owner, Site One, started seeing these things, he went into town and he bought a camcorder. And this man, believe me, I love him. He's a great guy, but he is the world's worst camcorder operator. In that he didn't know how to run the camera. He refused to put it on a tripod, so instead of looking at the motion of the object, you're looking at the motion of the operator. And yet, it's some startling stuff. If you look at it frame by frame, where you get the motion out of it, it is amazing stuff. And he gave us all of the video that he'd shot over these past 10 years. And again, these were all witnessed by numerous people, along with he and his wife. And we have, oh, gosh, I'm not sure, probably 6 or 7 hours of really incredible stuff. The large primary object changing shape, developing other light sources behind it, beside it, the large primary stationary, and a smaller light approaches from below and without even stopping reverses direction, moving at just tremendous speed, and other smaller objects coming out of, going into, flying around the primary. It's just totally incredible stuff.
Tell me this, Ted. You know, you are a premier expert in physical trace cases. You've got files from 3,500 or so cases from all over the world, electromagnetic effects and radar cases and physical traces, soil and plant life. What is the cumulative effect of all this evidence? I mean, is there a conclusion or a couple of conclusions that all of that stuff adds up to?
Well, in my mind, based on 40 years of research and looking at it as in as unbiased a manner as I possibly can, based on the data, not on what I believe or don't believe, but based on what you see, the conclusion that I arrive at is we're looking at constructed devices under intelligent control, and that is by no stretch a stretch. That's based on what they do, how they do it repeatedly since 1490. That's the earliest case that we have involving physical evidence, and which obviously would not be as strong a case as a recent one because you can't talk to the witnesses, but it is a well-documented case. And so where they're from, I couldn't hazard a guess, but or who's flying them, except 23.2% of the total cases involve humanoids. And about 96-97% of those cases involve little guys, 3 foot tall, thin, spindly bodies, typical.
You hinted about something earlier when we were talking about the mystery structure in Slovakia. You said that if you could get some samples, you'd have to be real careful about where you sent them.
Yeah.
Have you had problems in that regard, sending samples out for analysis or to agencies or something, and they don't come back?
Good Lord, yes. Yeah, Stan Friedman and I, we spent a lot of today together and talking, and we were talking about that very thing. In so many of the attempts to get analysis done, for example, the Delphos case, which is quite well known, Alan Hynek suggested, you know, well, maybe we should try to get some of the samples into major universities, into laboratories. So I called the nearest university, University of Missouri, and I found a geochemist named Paul Hostetler.
Let's just tell the audience that Delphos, Kansas, right, where this
yes.
circle appeared in the soil.
Yes,
and you, it
right.
was baked soil?
Yes, the okay. soil wouldn't admit water. It had been totally sapped of all more water. It was totally dehydrated. And the reason was we did find out through analysis from Oak Ridge that the soil was coated with something. And they did manage to send us microscopic images which showed this coating material and some icicle-like structures that you could see in the coating material that no one at Oak Ridge had ever seen before.
So Oak Ridge was nice enough to at least give you the analysis, but some of the samples you sent out, what happened to them?
Well, for example, the University of Missouri, and talking to this geochemist, and I told him what I had, and he said, yes, we would very much like to work with that. So I hand-delivered a substantial sample of the very freshest material to him, and he said, we'll get right on it. Well, over the next 6 months, Alan and I both called these people, and there was always, well, we're trying to decide what we should do. And so after 6 months, Alan said, let's go there. So he and I went, and they called a meeting of the Whigs at the University of Missouri, and we sat down at a great big long wooden table, And they hem-hawed around. And so finally, Alan, in one of his very rare mad occasions, stood up, slammed his fist on the table, and he said, "Gentlemen, what exactly have you done to analyze this material?" And one of the department heads said, "Well, we're still trying to decide what we should do. 6 months." And so Alan demanded the samples back, and they said, "Well, we're not sure where they're at." And the geochemist that agreed to do this was in Australia. And that's what we ran into time after time.
Did you ever see anything orchestrated in this where this happened time after time, like maybe somebody else was coming in and grabbing the material?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There were very good indicators that because they would, you know, why wouldn't you return the material if you were not going to look at it and it was there? And they wouldn't even let you see the material to determine it was still there. And, I mean, you just can't imagine how frustrating that gets over a period of many years, just trying to get some answers. And even the, Oak Ridge people, as they were telling us, you know, this is very strange material. They opened the samples, and where the ring samples were open, they went into, just huge coughing spasms. And the scientists themselves, I mean, there was something very odd going on in this material.
Okay, hold on, Ted. We'll come back. We're taking a short break. When we come back, we're going to open up the phone lines. Your questions for Ted Phillips, the world's foremost expert on landing site trace cases. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone, and good morning. We're talking with Ted Phillips, an expert in landing site trace cases, also investigator of the Marley Woods mystery and other matters. We'll be going to the phones in just a moment. First, though, Ted, I wanted to give you a chance to finish up your thought about that Oak Ridge result.
Yeah, the one of the really biggest frustrations that we've had, the Oak Ridge people were getting, I think, very close to coming up with some answers. And they were actually sending, as I said, microscopic images and so on. And some really encouraging comments. And then suddenly one day, Alan Hynek and I received letters from the director of the Orion Project, which was doing the analysis. And he said, due to a change in management, we can no longer look at this material. And, of course, they didn't send any of the samples back and no information beyond that point. And, you know, he and I talked about this extensively. And when you look at having to go to laboratories that have the sort of equipment, the capabilities to really get at something out of the ordinary, you're dealing pretty well with only laboratories with very close government affiliations and contracts. So we kind of arrived at the conclusion, why should they tell us anything?
I'm amazed you got anything out of Oak Ridge or anyone else.
Yeah, I am too, George, now looking back. And, you know, it really is aggravating that you have material that is so odd, and yet you can't get anything done with it. And we approached NASA several times, and no interest, at least as far as we were concerned.
Of course not. They're afraid of what the results might show. We're going to go to the phones on our wild card line. Eric in Wisconsin. Good morning, Eric.
Gentlemen, how are you guys doing?
All right.
Well, I've got a more or less my own little theory and hypothesis going on here. Especially now you're hearing a lot of the Bigfoot sightings, Chupacabra sightings, UFO sightings. And how they all happen in groupings. Now, sometimes it's a whole bunch of people in a town that are seeing it. Sometimes it's one or two people here and there. And I think it all breaks down to this, for me at least. And tell me if this doesn't make sense to you guys. You have your real events, okay? And then you have your hoaxes that are put on by the people that A, either want the attention or are using things as a smokescreen to divert your attention from really what's going on. And then, and or, you have what I believe is Project Bluebeam being implemented by the government. And I don't know if you guys have heard about Project Bluebeam or have looked into it. Have either of you two heard about this?
No.
No, I haven't.
Okay, basically what this is the government and Russia have satellites all positioned strategically, all up there in outer space. And what these satellites can do, everything that has a chip in it, i.e., you know, your television for the parental chip and your chip for scanning at the store and all these chips, can communicate with these satellites. And these satellites can send signals onto the sodium layer or the ozone layer, basically like a movie screen projector, i.e. making it look like normal sky, making it look like there's UFOs, making it look like there's Bigfoots, and activating these chips. And all these chips are activated on resonance frequencies. And basically,
hey, Eric, this is an interesting theory. It's a little out of Ted's area. Did you have a question for Ted?
Well, yeah, basically, as far as actual things with this cave you were talking about, did this gentleman and is what you're saying, you believe this thing is a ship, or is it like a monolith?
Yeah, that I wish I could answer that, but until we can actually see and examine this, based on the information that we have, it's a tremendously intriguing whatever, but it would be impossible to say, because Tony Hurok was a trained engineer, and he sat inside of this thing off and on for a week. And he looked at it, and he tried to understand it. Now, of course, this was 1944, and technology has moved along. A guy sitting there today might be able to understand some things that were beyond even a trained engineer in 1944. So it's about all I can tell you as far as what it is or what it might be. It would be purely a guess on my part, and I don't know. It's just terrifically interesting, and I think it's something we need to know more about.
Thanks for the call, Eric. I'm thinking, Ted, he was mentioning about this chip theory about how some of the images being seen by folks are essentially holographs or fake images. I guess that would not explain, though, the physical trace case evidence, the impressions left by a craft or whatever.
Well, and that's precisely the reason that that I stay with that sort of stuff. Because, for example, if you have an object in daylight very close to witnesses for a prolonged period of time, and you can see landmarks in front of, behind, and around the object, and you can watch the object generate various types of effects on its surroundings, and then you can go to that exact spot and find indentations, which after analysis indicate an object of 14 tons, you're looking at not a projection, but a very real object that has a lot of mass.
Okay, we're going to take a short break and come back with more of your calls for Ted Phillips on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. We're taking your calls for Ted Phillips. We're going east of the Rockies. Keith in Texas. Good morning, Keith.
Good evening. Like, this is getting incredibly frustrating to listen to right now, because I understand that Ted can't tell us the exact location or the people involved or anything like that, but at least tell us what state it's happening in. I'm assuming that it's somewhere around the Ozarks, because I recognize the vegetation is in the pictures. And then also, why did Ted not send or keep some of the sample material for himself instead of sending all of it to some of these researchers or institutions or whatever it was that accumulate samples?
That would indeed be a stupid move, and I didn't send all of the samples to laboratories. What lab would you suggest I send the remaining samples to?
I honestly, what I would say is this, and I don't know enough about it to recommend a specific lab, but I would say send it to multiple ones and then tell some of those about the others that have also received some samples, and then keep the others in the dark. And then you compare the excuses that they make up when they contact you back saying, well, you had a change in management or whatever. And, you know, and then if you're hearing the same excuses by more than one of them, then you know, obviously, that they're lying. And then, of course, the ones that you kept in the dark won't know that you sent it to other institutions. And hopefully one of them will be straightforward with you and tell you what they actually found. But also on the location, though, I hope you don't forget that one.
Yeah. No, it's not in the Ozarks.
I appreciate the call, Keith. The idea about sending this to multiple labs and giving them different versions of it, I know you've tried to send it to various labs. I guess part of the problem would be getting a lab to agree to accept it in the first place. You just don't send it in the mail and hope that they open it up and analyze it. You got to call them first, and they've got to express a willingness, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It is, first of all, tough to find a lab that will even fool with something. I suppose you could try to give it to them without mentioning a UFO. And actually, we did try that a number of times. And when they start seeing something extremely unusual, then you're right back into the same mode.
Because they would call you up and say, hey, what's the deal on the soil?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right, we're going to go west of the Rockies, Alex in Washington. Good morning, Alex.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll try and make this quick and short. First of all, I agree with you, Ted, by keeping the science to yourself. There's just too many idiots out there and too many morons that if you give out all your information, before you know it, there's going to be mass chaos, and before you know it, there's going to be condos there and real estate development, all that kind of stuff. It's just, it's a better, I don't agree with the first two callers, but I wanted to ask make a comment and a question. Because of all the people out there these days that are so skeptical, and I don't claim to be one of those. I think that there's something paranormal going on there. In your mind, since you're a good scientist, what made you comfortable that these lights in the Marley Woods are not of a hoax? Is there a surrounding population in the area? Is there people around? I saw the video on your website of these light bulbs, and if anybody wants to see it, it's an amazing video. Mm-hmm. There's obviously something flying around these light bulbs. In your mind, what has made you comfortable to eliminate the possibility of any kind of foul play in the area? And you should take a look at the South Mountain in Phoenix, Arizona, because the same kind of thing is happening in that area. And with all the technology that we have these days, besides just photography, we have radiological equipment, we have radar, we have infrared, we have all kinds of things. Why don't you just set up some equipment in an area and see, instead of just photography, if you catch some kind of a signal off there, so maybe there's a magnetic signal, maybe there's a SETI. SETI's idea is pointing it out into space. Well, why don't they point it right at this, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, actually, we would like to do all those things. And that's the reason we are making a lot of attempts to get the funding to buy the equipment to work along those lines. You make a very good point, and it is the way it should be done. Now, the problem, and I'm glad you mentioned SETI, if we had one-tenth of the budget of SETI, we would be getting some answers. And the problem is, if you have a zero-based budget, it's very difficult to acquire the equipment to do the proper work. So right now, we're doing the very best we can with nothing. And it's an unfortunate situation, but I can tell you for the past 40 years, that is precisely what UFO research has had to deal with, and that is a budget of zero. And occasionally, it's quite humorous to hear people who think that, for example, folks that do a lot of lectures are making a lot of money, and they're in the UFO business to make money. There is no money to make in ufology. I can assure you that.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for that call. First-time caller line, Paulette in beautiful Marina Del Rey, California. Good morning, Paulette.
Good morning. I'm really enjoying the show, and I was wondering the same thing about sending samples to multiple labs, but with all the mounting evidence and all the sightings and all the phenomenal things that have happened worldwide, there seems to be, like, have you ever sent samples outside of the United States, outside of the Northern Hemisphere, where other people have had some fantastic sightings and findings of material and evidence of something else being here with us, some other visitors or extraterrestrials or something happening, you know? Have you ever sent anything out of the country to other labs? I'm sure there's got to be other places where people would be more open to give you a real answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a lab without government contracts or U.S. government contracts.
Exactly. And that, again, is truly an excellent point. But we, for example, again, back to the Delphos, we probably sent more samples out to more laboratories trying to pin down the Delphos material than any other case we've worked with. And as a matter of fact, I sent samples to an extremely high caliber scientist and laboratory in England. And I have piles of correspondence with him. And he did everything he could to isolate the coding material and then to analyze that particular material. And he simply ran out of options, and I could show anyone that wanted to look numerous emails and letters where he said you would have to go to a NASA-sponsored laboratory to be able to get the equipment to finish this. He had gone as far as he could go, excuse me, and he was at a very major laboratory, and he just reached the end of his rope as far as progressing with the analysis. So we didn't have the government problem there. It was just they couldn't do the work, and there are not a lot of laboratories that can do the very elaborate tests necessary to separate out a material like that.
Thanks for the call, Paulette. We'll try to get started on another call on our wild card line. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. K. Doe in New York. Hello?
Yes, hello. Yes, hello. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling in regards to your, you may have mentioned Tallinn before and something buried near Tallinn. And I have a little bit of knowledge about that. That's in the Republic of Estonia, which was occupied by the Soviet Union for over 50 years. On the outside of Tallinn, there's a town called Perita, and I believe it's there. There was a lady who has a house, and they brought in several psychics and people to try to communicate with an identity or something buried in the ground. And when they started to dig, there was a Japanese team that went there. All types of activities happened, like her furniture started floating, and supposedly this thing or whatever it is gave type of answer back that will come out when we want to. And they've been there for so long. But my personal opinion of it is that these type of things, like what this gentleman was talking about, is really it's a deception. It's a spiritual deception. These are forces of evil, the demonic identities, and these are like holes, if you will, where they come out and manifest themselves. Because everything what the description, what this individual was saying before about black, thin type creature, etc., is exactly what people have experienced with demonic encounters.
That's a tough one to prove. You know, Ted is in the business of analyzing physical evidence that's left behind. He's reluctant to draw a conclusion about who's behind it or where these beings or this intelligence is from, whether it be extraterrestrial or interdimensional or spiritual or whatever. Am I phrasing that right, Ted?
Yes, absolutely.
So I appreciate the we appreciate the suggestion, but I think that's probably the conclusion that this is demonic or whatever. It's probably a little bit beyond the ability of Ted's to conclude based on the physical evidence that he has. We appreciate the call, though. We're going to take a short break, then come back with more of your calls for Ted Phillips on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. We have just under 20 minutes left with our guest, Ted Phillips. I'll take as many of your calls as I can. We're going to go to our international line, Jim, in Alberta, Canada. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, George. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thanks.
I was just wondering, what do you think about out-of-body experiences? I've met several people, and they describe going towards a bright light. What do you think of that?
Well, Ted, are you have you done any work on that?
Well, I've just met several people. I work in a facility where there's a lot of geriatric people, and I've had discussions with them, and I've met several people that really believe that there's something out there.
I've done only a little bit of research myself. Read a couple of the books on it. It seems like there's something there to it. I know I've seen a lot of the debunkers who think that there's a more prosaic explanation, but I'm by no means an expert. Ted, you want to weigh in?
There wouldn't be a lot I could add to that.
Okay.
Really, that's I do think, however, I'll throw it in quickly, that people do have very interesting experiences that definitely should be studied. I do believe that.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jim. East of the Rockies, Stephen in St. Joe, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Back in 1999, I was hauling a load of asphalt at 2 o'clock in the morning to Broken Bow, Nebraska. I was traveling up Highway 183. It was quite stormy and rainy. And there was an orb that come up just past Hays, Kansas on Highway 183 in Ellis County. The orb itself was, I would say, orangish, like the orange the moon when it first comes up, and it came right up the side of my truck, even though in the heavy rain and the thundering and lightning and stuff, and it scared me so bad. Anyway, I was impelled to roll down my window and see if I could touch it, and I did, and I'm traveling about 60 miles an hour, my arm's wet, the rain's hitting my arm, and it's stinging, you know, but there was like a light shock to my arm when I touched it. But when I pulled my hand back in the cab of the truck, it was like a cobweb with sap on my fingers. Anyway, 2 days later, I got sick. And I have like this cold, and I can't get rid of it. And I don't even know where to go with this, because it seems like every year in August I get sick.
Ted, you ever heard of anybody making contact with one of these things and having residual effects?
Well, actually, I have. I would be interested to know when did this take place?
1999.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. You know, I would very much appreciate if you would go to our website and just email me that information. That sounds very interesting. It does.
And the thing is the reason why I'm concerned now is it's not about me. It's about my wife and kids.
Mm-hmm.
This year, they got sick with me, and in fact, I got a 13-year-old teenage daughter that's down now, and we all got sick last week, and it's the same cold, and it comes every August,
mm-hmm.
and you know, basically the same time you know, every year I get sick in August.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. How did this thing disappear after you touched, you reached out the window?
I touched it, and it just stayed on the side of my truck. And, I mean, it just kind of drifted back, into the rain where it just kind of faded out.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is I dropped off my load of asphalt at Broken Bow, Nebraska. I came back the next day, and I'm guessing it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock back towards Hayes, Kansas. And there was a lot of government vehicles, military vehicles, and, Suburbans with government plates on them of all different kind of makes and sizes and stuff. And I just found it odd. You know, we're close to Riley,
mm-hmm.
but still, I found it odd that, you know, I seen this, I touched it, and I came back, and then that following morning, or actually, I guess, afternoon, there was government vehicles out where I seen it.
Hmm. Well, I really appreciate your telling us about that, and I really wish you would email me. So I perhaps could ask you some more questions. And, you know, as I always like to say, you know, we're interested in the information, not in, names or anything like that. And, whatever you would like to tell us about it, I would like to hear. That's very interesting. And I am extremely interested in the small objects, because it seems that those kinds of reports are increasing since the early 90s, and I'd like to gather that kind of information to compare to things going on in Marley and other areas. So I really would appreciate if you could email me at the website. I'd really appreciate that.
Stephen, thank you for the call. We're sending good thoughts to you and your family. Hope your health is okay. We're going to go west of the Rockies now. Mark in Reno, Nevada. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Okay.
Great show tonight. George, you're doing a great job.
Thanks.
And Ted, I'm the Nevada State Director of the Mutual UFO Network, and we send love to you guys. And I think you're doing just a bang-up job, man. I have much respect for what you do.
Well, thank you. Didn't I just get an email from you?
Yes, you did today.
Well, I've been on the road, my friend, and I'll answer that as soon as I get home.
Well, how about if you answer it right now, because that's
okay.
Why I'm calling. I'm working on a similar case, having just a ton of video that's being sent to me.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman is fortunate enough that the traffic is happening over at his home. But I can't let you know where it is. Obviously, you feel the same way
yes,
I do.
Yes. Yeah.
But my question is, being you have videotaped and your witnesses are videotaping, are you using infrared night vision?
Basically, what we've used all along is the night mode function on the camcorders. Primarily because now some of these things are extremely bright, and you wouldn't need to do that.
Right.
And, of course, you lose quite a bit of photographic quality when you go into night mode. But we're going to set up a couple of cameras where we don't use that because what we're really wanting to do is capture this very odd color. And if you're dealing with bright objects, then the night mode really wouldn't be required, shouldn't be.
Sometimes they're far away and it's needed.
Mm-hmm.
What we're finding out over the course of the several hours of videotaping is they react to the infrared beam. They know they're being tracked, and that's why I'm asking you if you've noticed when videotaping and you have your night shot on, do these things react? Do they turn left? Do they, you know, the classic zigzag movements, you know what I'm talking about? Have you ever seen that with the shooting you've done with infrared?
No, we actually haven't to this point, but that's an interesting point, and we'll certainly keep that in mind. So you're having repeat events similar to Marley in your area.
Mark? It's actually in another state. I can't mm-hmm. disclose it, but I'm just privy. I was the one he chose to in MUFON to be able to present this evidence to,
mm-hmm.
and this was back in 2005, and it's been ever since then. He's been sending stuff, and what we found out is with his infrared beam, they're reacting to it.
Mm.
And so that's what we've found, and they'll go farther away over a period of time because they know they're being tracked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm going to say right now, but I'd like to talk with you in depth at a later time about this and the infrared and how that's affecting what you're shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to. Really.
All right, Mark, thanks for that call, and maybe when the time is right, we'll have you on the show to talk about these results. Thanks for calling in. We're going to go to our wild card line now, Joe in Arizona. Good morning, Joe.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to tell Ted, I've had some experience of taking samples to a national lab and get results back, and I got the samples back too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had an associate that developed a technology. He's a PhD in nuclear physics. He developed a technology and a machine that used that technology to build gem-grade diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
And the De Beers funded him to do this, and he built the machine, and then he was able to do other things, like combined materials never been combined before, like sapphire and aluminum. He could combine sapphire and aluminum. It would make material as light as aluminum, but as strong as steel.
Mm-hmm.
And so, at any rate, the De Beers shorted him a couple million, so he took the machine down, dismantled it, came back to the States, and he told me, he gave me some of these samples to take to a lab, a qualified lab. So I chose Los Alamos Laboratories up in New Mexico.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now I did have a state, New Mexico State Department of Industrial Development financed the test. They paid Los Alamos for doing the test. Now, maybe this made the lab be a little more honest than whatnot, but I had no problem. I got the tests all ran, about seven different samples of materials that had never been seen on Earth before, and they gave me a full report. It was in about 3 or 4 weeks. I had the report and got all the samples back. So that would be my suggestion, is to approach Los Alamos Laboratories.
Well, I appreciate that. As a matter of fact, we did go through Los Alamos a number of times. Maybe what we've been doing wrong is not having the money to pay for the analysis. But we had the same problem with Los Alamos as other government interlocked laboratories. And of course, we've never had, you know, great sums of money to pay. And analysis is extremely expensive, depending on the tests that you require. And so that, I'm glad you had good results.
Thanks, Joe. We'll have to hear more about these materials that you got sometime. We're going to go to Cindy in Utah, also on our wild card line. Good morning, Cindy. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I'd like to know what his opinion is on HAARP, and I'll take his answer off the air. Thank you.
You know much about HAARP, Ted?
You know, I know very little. I don't know enough about it to make any sensible comments, really. I've heard a lot of different opinions, a lot of different no, I just couldn't comment
okay.
on that.
Okay. Clay in Missouri, also on our wild card line. Good morning, Clay. How can we help
you? Good morning, gentlemen. Question for you here. I just wanted to tell you a short story and then get your comment on it. These lights that you see flying around, my friend and I, in April 2006, we were in Las Vegas, and we just decided we were bored, not doing so well on the table, so we went up north. Near Area 51. And we have some video footage, which actually I emailed you, Mr. Knapp, a link to that site on YouTube.
Is this the two ladies who go into the site?
What's that?
Is this the video of these two ladies who drive past the... No?
No. This is my friend Cole and I.
Okay.
And we basically, you know, we had seen industrial sites and things like that on the way up, you know, power plants, and it has those amber glowing lights. So we thought when we saw something like that out on the side, we thought, well, that must just be like a tower or something. But it was two lights just floating in the air. And then about a half an hour later, well, we saw three lights come on in sequence, move, stop. And they stayed there about 4 minutes, and the whole time they were there, there were other series of lights, like almost like one would come on, and then as soon as it would turn off, another one would come on above it. And then right as it was turning off, another one would come on above it, and they would stair-step all the way up into the three. And then it did that off on the left. They came stair-stepping across the sky into the three, and then the three burned out. And we've got the whole thing on video. Just wanted to know, or just give your comment on that.
I don't remember seeing the video, so maybe you can send it to me again. I've heard, I've seen that kind of stuff described before. In fact, I've got a little piece of video myself from probably 10 years ago in the same area, and I think I eventually concluded that maybe it was lights that were bouncing from different towers in a sequence. But I don't know if that actually describes what you captured on video or not. I guess I'll have to take a look at the tape, and maybe we'll get back to you. We got time for one more call. Monty, on our first-time caller. Line. Monty is in Paris, California. Good morning, Monty.
Good morning. How are you gentlemen doing?
Hi.
I have a little information on that ship that's in there. A few years ago, I had a friend that was telling me a story about some, like, little plates that he saw come off the UFO, and he collected them. Well, when you go to this ship, there's nothing really on this planet that you're going to be able to take a sample of. You're talking about this gentleman that put it on his belt with some kind of bird glue or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only sample you're going to get because he used a plasma cutter. He used a diamond cutter. He used pretty much everything, but I've noticed, because I've actually felt it, we dropped it on the floor, and it actually broke like glass. So it's going to be very hard for you to actually cut into this substance in order to get a sample out.
Well, assuming that it's the same substance.
Right, because it's going to the sample that I saw, he actually sent to the laboratories and got no information from anybody and never got the samples back.
And where's this from?
This was from Nevada. And... what we found out, it looks like a normal tile, like the one in your bathroom, but it's black and it's smooth like marble. And he sent it to Coast to Coast, and he sent it to other laboratories. And the only thing that actually happened out of that was some gentlemen in black coats actually came around trying.
Hey, Monty, I'm sorry, we're out of time. That sounds like a fascinating story. Ted Phillips, thanks for joining us. Folks can find out more about your investigations on your website. There's a link on the Coast to Coast site. And sure wish you good luck with your trip to Slovakia, and I might have to talk to you about going along on that one.
All right. Sounds good, George.
Thanks very much for joining us. And folks, if you're in the neighborhood of Nevada next weekend, there's a little UFO get-together at the Little Ailey Inn in Rachel, Nevada, which is the gateway to Area 51. So I'm sure they'd welcome you there. It's always a fun trip. And I'll be back next week with more of Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for listening.